Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm your host, Laura Makin-Isherwood. Russia's use of private military companies, or PMCs, is no secret, despite President Vladimir Putin's decision to try to keep them a little bit under wraps. But most notable of all is the Wagner Group. But their existence was cast into some doubt following a failed mutiny attempt against the Kremlin. After the group's leader, Yevgeny Prigozhin, died in what the Kremlin says was a plane crash, not an assassination attempt, many wondered if Wagner would fold and what might take its place in a potential vacuum. Wagner continues to exist, though with weakened power, and Russia has started calling on other PMCs in its place. One is cropping up frequently, Redut PMC. But what is it? How does it operate? And why does Putin continue to rely on these mercenaries? Joining me to explore those questions and more is Dr. Marina Myron, postdoctoral researcher at the War Studies Department at King's College London. Marina, thanks for joining me in The Bunker.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. Wagner has become a bit of a household name here since their failed uprising. But who or what exactly is Redut PMC?
Well, to understand who they are, we have to go back to 2008. That's when the PMC was officially formed. So they are much older than Wagner, but they have been operating in the shadows. And according to some early accounts, such PMCs were owned by oligarchs. For instance, the former FSB officer Igor Strelkov said that they were owned by oligarchs and were tasked with protecting the oligarch subsidiaries. However, new information has come out, and this information says that Redut is managed by the main directorate of the General Staff of the Armed Forces, known as GRU. So that would make Redut not actually a private military company, but rather a company owned by the government because it's running under the auspice of the Ministry of Defense. And this company is like a small army, if you will, with about 20 armed formations and the strength of tens of thousands of individuals. So we have to look at it a little bit differently. Also, we can say that Wagner, to a certain extent, was also controlled by the Kremlin because the Kremlin was funding Wagner operations. However, when we're talking about Redut, it's much more embedded into the Ministry of Defense and is under its direct control.
How is that allowed? Because if that was to take place here in the UK, for instance, I just think that there would be uproar. At the minute, of course, everybody's supposed to declare what armed forces we have and what intelligence groups there are at least sort of known within the government and also semi-publicly. How can Russia get away with that?
I don't think that there is a lot of resistance to this, to be honest, at least not in the public sphere. We remember how the Wagner troops were greeted by the people and everybody was very supportive, despite the fact that there was a questionable legal status of the PMC. And what Russia wants, essentially, is to have the monopoly on violence when it comes to the use of armed forces. They don't want to have private military companies. And there have been discussions within the Duma when the question with Wagner arose, how to deal with it. And especially after the so-called mutiny by Prigozhin, some politicians were saying, well, we actually need to legalize PMCs. And others were saying, no, the state should be in full control of its security forces. And we don't need those companies that could potentially endanger our own security because you cannot control them. So I don't think that the public cares much. There are some, obviously, in political circles who care about the legal status of such PMCs, but it's better from the Kremlin's perspective to have those groups, enmeshed within the broader structure of the Ministry of Defense, especially when it comes to the GRU and the GRU. And I think as long as these groups are deployed in order to further Russia's interests, nobody really minds.
So where exactly are they being used?
It's difficult to say where and how they were used. From what we know, there is no, let's say, reliable information from what can be understood is that they have been used in different formation, but mostly to conduct offensive operations, so tip of the spear, so to say. But they might have been used in the Donbass in some sort of supporting function. So it's not necessarily just combat tasks that they're tasked with. So it's sort of like a little army within the army.
Who are the key players then within Radut?
Well, one name that appears on the actual website of Radut is Konstantin Mirzans. It's not confirmed. Apparently, he should be the commander and the leader of Radut, but from my understanding, the actual leader of Radut would be Yunus Bek, the deputy defense minister, who is actually a military officer and somebody who personally knew Prigozhin and who was with Prigozhin on the day of a mutiny. So Yunus Bek Yevkurov is certainly a name that we should remember. Another name, perhaps the one I have already mentioned, is Anton Elizarov, is the Yaza leader of Wagner, the one who is leading operations in Africa, and Andrei Troshev, known as Sidoy, so the white-haired, is sort of fulfilling the role of Dmitry Utkin in this case.
I was reading reports that Radut had been involved in some sort of planned assassination attempt of President Volodymyr Zelensky as well at the start of the Ukraine war, but it failed. Have you heard much about that?
Unfortunately not, because no information on that subject could be confirmed. The information was coming mostly from one side, saying that the FSB was actually tasked with coup d'etat. So in how far Radut could have been involved in that, we don't know. We could speculate and we could say, well, it would be logical to deploy those kind of companies to help the FSB, to support the FSB. That being said, the FSB was back then playing the main role in Ukraine. And after this huge intelligence failure in April 2022, Putin decided to sideline the FSB and to give the GRU free rein in Ukraine and change the tasks of the FSB to guarding the border and so sort of demoting them, because he was probably enraged that the whole plan of coup d'etat and the quick war, three-day war, didn't work out.
Was there any competition between the head of Radut and the head of Wagner, Yevgeny Prigozhin?
Well, it seems like it could have been that they were assigned different tasks. So somehow they managed to coordinate their actions on the ground. And at least I haven't been aware of any conflict. Even with the recruitment, when Wagner was still around, Radut started recruiting from prisons only after Wagner finished recruiting from prisons, which was in February 2023. And we do remember Defense Minister Shoigu disallowing Prigozhin to continue his recruitment. So it seems like they tried to keep these two groups apart or as much apart as they could in order to prevent potential clashes, given that one is more on the side of Putin and the other is more on the side of the Ministry of Defense. And in all of his speeches, Prigozhin never, ever mentioned them. He never mentioned the conflict with them. He mentioned the conflict with the Ministry of Defense and with the way that the military was being run and corrupt generals and things like that. But he never said that, you know, your guys from Radut are undermining our operations. So it didn't seem to be a conflict there. However, once Wagner was out of the picture, it seems like Radut is taking its place.
Wagner and Radut have been operating side by side. They're not the only two PMCs being used by Russia, are they?
Well, there are some others. For instance, there is Patriot PMC, which is also apparently under the auspice of the Ministry of Defense. Then there are various PMCs owned by oligarchs about which we don't know that much. So it seems to be like there are quite a lot of these actors operating in the shadows. And the interesting part is that we started hearing about Wagner first in Ukraine from 2014 onwards, and then in Syria specifically, where Wagner went rogue in Deir ez-Zor, clashing with the American troops back then. That what made it public that Wagner was operating on the ground. However, along Wagner, there was this Patriot PMC, which is also part of the Ministry of Defense, and Redoubt PMC, both also operating in Syria, which is interesting, but nobody knew anything about them until, I think, 2021, when Igor Strelkov started releasing information about different operatives in Syria. We don't know how reliable it is because he had his own interests, but that's the first time when we heard about them.
How vital are PMCs to Russia's success, or the current regime's success at least?
I think they're absolutely essential because Russia can operate with plausible deniability. So whatever is left of Wagner, it's being led by a commander named Lotus, who used to be very close to Prigozhin. And this group, or this portion of Wagner, is going to continue operations in Africa because it is very difficult to dismantle the group and take over the African component of Wagner operations. The person in question here, his name is Anton Elizarov. And so this group was a group that didn't want to sign the contract with the Ministry of Defense. And then there is another group of Wagner, which broke off from Wagner after the so-called mutiny. And it's led by a former colonel, Andrei Troshev. And this colonel is now, there was a meeting between Putin back in end of September, Troshev and Yunusbek Elizarov, who is the deputy defense minister, and the task was to recruit new units into Redoubt. And so this ex-Wagner member, Troshev, is being tasked specifically with this. And so what we're expecting now is that these units are going to be deployed to Ukraine. The other branch of Wagner, which is doing their operations in Africa, is not going to be involved anymore. However, Wagner was very effective in Ukraine, and so there needs to be this gap filled right now to solve complex battlefield tasks without getting any publicity on the casualties. And that is also why Redoubt was recruiting from prisoners. They were not as successful as Prigozhin in terms of their recruitment, but they needed somebody to just mass, it's critical mass to send into battle. So we're talking about different kinds of soldiers, those who are not very well trained and not very well prepared for battle, but you can easily spare them and overwhelm the Ukrainian forces. And this is one of the things that the Russians have been doing, and they're doing it at the expense of those prisoners, because at the end of the day, in terms of publicity, it's not as critical as having Russian officers die.
How many losses are there on the battlefield? I don't know if you can get hold of that information anywhere, if you're saying those deaths are not reported within those PMCs, because it feels like if you're recruiting from prisons and saying, you know, these people are not going to be lost or missed and we don't have to count them, signing up to be part of a PMC is essentially signing up to die, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, because those people are in prison. They would get a very good salary. They would get a life insurance. They would get all sorts of benefits. And they, same as with Wagner, they will, their families will be promised compensation if their family member dies during an operation. So it's a good way to earn money quickly. But it is a very dangerous job that they're doing. And this is why the PMCs are sent in first, in order to shape the battlefield, in order to make it easier for the regular forces than to conduct an offensive operation and increasing the chance of success for the outcome of this operation. The Battle of Palmyra in Syria is an example where the Syrian forces entered Palmyra just when the journalists did to claim victory. But in reality, those who liberated Palmyra were the Wagner troops. And so for Ukraine, again, this is very important to do that. And people joined because of different reasons. Some people are actually convinced that they can make a useful contribution. And when we're talking about the prisoners, they have no choice. Either they die in prison or they die on the battlefield, or maybe if they survive, then they are pardoned. So if you have served in Redut for 6 months, you then will be pardoned. And that's the kind of the marketing, the PR is a hook to get these people to join.
The Ministry of Defense in Russia also released a statement saying that this group is specifically trying to recruit women. Why are they looking for females?
Well, their reasoning for looking for females is because females can be useful in many roles. And I'm not even talking about background roles like a military nurse. There are women, and this is a recent article from October 23rd, which says that female snipers are great, and whoever wants to join, why should we exclude them? Or female drone pilots. So they are seeking to build a female drone squad. So in other words, there are tasks which females can do as well as males, even if they don't have the same physical strength and stamina. Still, given the new technologies and given the fact that the use of drones has mushroomed all across Ukraine, they need more pilots, more drone pilots, and so they have started to recruit women to fill their ranks. And there have been some interviews with females from the so-called Donetsk People's Republic who are fighting alongside their husbands and who are happy to join.
So they're running out of men.
I think they want to broaden the spectrum of whom they're recruiting. And within NATO, there has been this debate for years that females should be included, not because we're running out of men. I think that for the Russians, it is a strategic move because you can get more manpower, and females excel at different kinds of tasks than men. Females in military roles usually deal with the likes of logistics. And here again, drone operators, drone pilots. So I think that they are trying to find the best people for the selection of jobs that they have. I don't think that they will be sending women to the front to fight, because that would be a waste. I think they are trying to make a strategic use of additional capabilities that women have to offer.
President Vladimir Putin says that he doesn't recognize the legitimacy of PMCs. Why does he say this publicly when it's clear that they're being used?
Well, it's very simple, because there is a law that prohibits them, and he hasn't changed the law. So he cannot contradict his own laws. And as far as Redut is concerned, it's part of the Ministry of Defense. So technically, it's not against the law. And what Putin doesn't want is a kind of fragmentation of power. And I think he learned his lesson with Wagner. He never considered giving it a legal status in Russia, despite all the work that Wagner has done for the Kremlin and despite the fact that Kremlin has been funding it, because it would set a precedent. And this is something that Putin doesn't want. So he wants to make sure that him and the Ministry of Defense is in control. And Wagner was very useful, because Wagner helped Putin to keep the Ministry of Defense in check.
What do you think will happen then in Ukraine? Do you think that Russia will succeed in its special military operation, as it calls it, its invasion?
Well, that's a very good question, and I wish I knew the answer to it. We have to consider many factors when trying to assess the current situation. I think one of the most important factors is the current situation in Israel, and specifically in Gaza, and the capability of Western countries to keep on supporting Ukraine at the same rate that it has done so far. So Unfortunately, from my point of view, in terms of the military capabilities of the Ukrainian armed forces, they are there. But the problem is, if they are not supplied with enough ammunition, if they don't get air power on time, this is all, unfortunately, wasted effort. If we compare it to Russia, with the fact that it has much more potential in terms of manpower, and Russia is not very concerned, as we have learned, about casualties. And Russia doesn't have to comply with the international laws of war and doesn't have to prove anything to anybody. It has its allies or those who are sitting on the fence within the international community. It has supporters such as North Korea and Iran. So Russia is fighting essentially a geopolitical war. This is not about Ukraine for Russia. This is about the international order, which has, in Russia's eyes, become too unipolar with the U.S. dominance. And so Russia is now gathering sympathetic countries to say that we need to fight this unipolar order and make it multipolar again. And Ukraine is just one small component of that. However, it is a component which is very important to Russia, and the fact that Ukraine wanted independence after the break of the Soviet Union in 1991, it has never been digested by Russia. For Russia, it was a sort of an amputation, whereas with the Baltic states, they never really identified with Russia. They were always culturally different and so on. So the Russians were not surprised about those, but Ukraine has been critical to Russia for many centuries, I would argue. And so Russia is not about to give up on that. And I think that in the contest of wills, all factors considered, that it might come to a deadlock, but it doesn't look good for Ukraine. And General Zaluzhny said as much in his recent Economist article, the difficulty of fighting the Russians and the fact that some expectations or many of the expectations have not been met. And at some point, the time will run out. The will, the money, the ammunition, and so on. And that's what Russia is betting on.
And while the eyes of the world are on Israel and Gaza at the moment, then that focus is detracted even more. Dr. Marina Myron, thank you for joining me in the bunker.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, if you enjoyed this episode and want more like this one, why not back us on Patreon for just £3 a month? You'll get access to all our episodes before anyone else and the chance to get your hands on some exclusive merchandise. Most of all, though, you'll be helping to keep important conversations like this one going. I'm Laura Makin-Isherwood, reporting from The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Bunker Daily was written and presented by Laura Makin-Isherwood. The producer was Chris Jones, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.